This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening to Stateside. This show and this podcast are made possible with your support. $5 or $10 a month helps to pay for these conversations you listen to. So make your contribution right now at michiganradio.org or call 888-258-9866. It's our spring fun drive on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It has been since 2002 since top state officials have gotten a pay raise, and then most took a 10% pay cut a few years ago as Michigan was just starting to struggle back from the recession. So now unemployment's at its lowest level in some 14 years, and state revenues are growing. Is there an appetite in Lansing for a pay raise? The State Officers' Compensation Committee is the panel that's appointed by the governor and charged with deciding whether state officials should get a raise. Detroit Free Press reporter Paul Egan's been tracking the panel's activities, and he's with us now. Paul, which elected officials are we talking about?
We're talking about the governor, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, attorney general, state lawmakers, and justices of the Supreme Court. And because other judges' salaries are tie-barred to the justices' salaries, you're really talking about the entire judiciary as well.
So they do some fact-finding, they take a look at salaries. What happens when they make their recommendations?
Well, what happens now, and this is a big difference from what used to happen, Cindy, is they make a recommendation, and then the legislature, both chambers, has to vote to approve any pay increases that they recommend. The way it always used to work, and this is how they ended up getting fairly significant pay hikes in 2000 and 2002, was that once the commission reported, unless the legislature voted to reject the recommendation, it would automatically come into effect. And there was those pay increases that came in 2000 and 2002, there was a big public backlash about that, and Michigan actually amended its constitution in 2002 to change that. And that's, you know, part of the reason. A bigger reason is probably just the economy's been so bad until recently, but that's part of the reason these state officials haven't had another pay increase since then, because a lot of times politicians are reluctant to vote themselves a pay hike, although they're always set so they take effect on the next two-year cycle for state House members at least.
Well, so we've got the fact that they've met once. They're going to meet again May 13th, so there's talk about it now. Is there an appetite in Lansing to say yes to a pay raise?
Well, probably not for most of the officials, and just the fact that they sent out notices before the first meeting to both chambers of the House, for example, the governor's office. Nobody came and spoke at the first meeting saying, you know, we want a pay hike. And the chairman said that he interpreted that to mean that there may be a contentment with the status quo. However, the judges whose salaries are affected by these decisions, other than the ones lower than the Supreme Court justices, they didn't get any notice of this meeting because, you know, the commission isn't charged with dealing with them specifically. They're just charged with dealing with the justices. So I've actually heard from some judges who said, well, gee, we weren't even aware they were meeting. And I do expect you'll hear some representations from judges' associations likely at the next meeting, because that's been the main concern. Even the last two times this commission has met, they've only recommended increases for the judges, not for anybody else. And the legislature has not approved those increases either.
And, of course, as we've heard plenty from Lansing, even though things are getting better, and as we say, unemployment's at its lowest level since 2001 and revenues are growing, we have this sticky problem of those corporate tax credits being redeemed, and we're hearing a lot of talk of state budget problems.
Sure. And, you know, you've also got this question on May 5th where voters are being asked to significantly increase taxes through increasing the sales tax, increasing gas tax. And so that's another thing that probably has the public less than enthusiastic about giving a pay raise, because a lot of them say, well, you know, the lawmakers didn't do their job in coming up with a road funding plan. They punted the issue to voters. And so there's some of that feeling out there as well.
So there's another meeting May 13th. What do you think we'll see happen, Paul?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if we saw happen what we saw in both 2013 and 2011, where the commission recommends a pay increase for the justices only, which would thereby give an increase to all the circuit and district court judges in Michigan, the probate judges. And then whether the legislature acts on it or not will remain to be seen. But that seems like the most likely scenario.
Paul Egan with the Detroit Free Press. Always good to talk with you, Paul. Thank you so much.
You too. Thank you.
It's our spring fun drive here on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
The best and the brightest.
Part of the community. The next idea.
We have to start to change the dialogue on immigration, and we have to start to talk about it for what it really is.
What makes a city attractive to new immigrants? The immigrants who start new businesses, bring innovative ideas, and the energy to make those ideas happen. It's those immigrants who can pump new life into struggling Michigan cities. As we look for solutions, one question often asked is, with all the glamorous cities in America, why would immigrants want to settle in smaller cities like Flint and Saginaw, which are firmly situated in flyover country? Our latest contributor to The Next Idea knows firsthand why. Harsha Nahata grew up in Michigan's sizable South Asian immigrant community. Her parents moved to the United States from India and eventually settled in Saginaw, where her father still practices medicine today.
So one thing I've definitely noticed, people gravitate towards familiarity. Almost regardless of the place, if somebody has strong ties or close ties, whether it's family ties or friend ties or to somebody that already lives there, it becomes an incentive to go to that place because you have some sort of familiarity. You have a person that you can count on that can show you the ropes, and it kind of, I think, helps buffer that process of moving to a completely new country.
Harsha took this notion that familiarity is a highly attractive force for immigrants and turned it into a plan for Flint. A few years ago, she met with Flint city officials as well as representatives from the Chamber of Commerce and the four local colleges and universities. And she also asked immigrants already living in Flint what they thought.
Basically, a survey was conducted about what types of things drew them to the Flint area, what types of things would convince them to stay in this area after their schooling or residency was done, and what types of things in terms of amenities or community support or even things like housing, activities, support groups, did they feel were lacking in Flint that would be helpful to them for adjusting and then also wanting to build the life in a community in Flint.
While Nahata says that reforming our broken immigration system is crucial, there are still things we can do at the grassroots level. The biggest one, she says, is for Flint to organize and establish a more formal welcoming center that could offer new immigrants all kinds of assistance.
And that could be anything from hosting events, from introducing them to the local population that's already there, from facilitating more of an exchange between the existing population and the new one, and then also kind of using local cultural organizations and the current immigrant community to reach out to their networks and help recruit people to the area as well.
Welcoming centers are becoming more popular, especially in the Rust Belt, where cities like Detroit and Cleveland are looking to boost their declining populations with new immigrants. She thinks a welcoming center initiative for Flint and Saginaw would also work well, taking advantage of the significant immigrant populations in and around the area. But she's careful to stress one thing. The longtime local residents must be included in the process in order to prevent an unwelcoming backlash.
Instead of improving literacy in the current population or finding the current population jobs or building their skill sets, you're focusing attention on bringing in new people. And that's seen as a mutually exclusive set of things. And I think the biggest aspect of getting people to care is to remove that.
Nahata says having a framework in place to build a sense of togetherness is crucial. With community buy-in, the Welcoming Center will have the goals and vision to improve the city in ways where everyone benefits. Of course, this is not a cure-all, she says, nor is it the only way to rebuild Michigan cities. New immigrants alone aren't going to transform Flint and Saginaw.
It's not a supplement or a thing you can do instead of still being able to empower and provide for the current population. But if you are able to get new people and new ideas, you're able to get new ways of thinking that could further inspire new growth or a different type of growth, especially when it mixes with the existing population.
Using Michigan's existing immigrant populations to attract more talent is the subject of Harsha Nahata's essay. You'll find it on the Next Idea page at michiganradio.org. And while there, share your comments and ideas with us about how to break the status quo in Michigan. It's our spring fun drive here on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
The state of Michigan.
Ensuring quality products today.
Drive across the country and flip through the dial of your radio.
By prosthetics.
And chances are you'll find that station. The one playing Eric Clapton, Led Zeppelin, The Who, The Rolling Stones, the classic rock radio station. Well, did you know that classic rock format was born in Michigan nearly 30 years ago? Oakland County-based radio consultant Fred Jacobs was part of that birth, and he is with us now. Fred, tell us what was happening in radio in 1985 that kind of got you thinking about this whole idea of this classic rock format.
Well, a big part of it, Cindy, was the whole MTV phenomenon, and everything was all about what was new right now at that moment, and to a great degree, that older legacy, heritage, nostalgia music was pretty much being ignored on the radio, and so I just connected some dots. I always have done a lot of audience research, and the more listeners you talk to, it was true back then, it's true today, they can really tell you the story if you actually sit down and listen to them. And so we kept hearing that there were all these concerns that older music that people had grown up with really weren't being played all that much on the radio, and so it was really just a matter of kind of going into the library and figuring it out.
Well, then, as you were developing this format, give us kind of a quintessential sampling of the kind of artists and songs that you saw as being perfect classic rock.
Well, the whole thing really comes down to the golden age of rock, and when it finally dawned on me that it wasn't just about nostalgia, but that the period of rock, really starting from the Beatles and at that time going out into the late 70s, wasn't just a period of time, but was music that mattered, was the music that people would be listening to 100 years from now. I mean, that was really a big part of it. And then I started seeing some kind of pop culture validation. The Big Chill came out around that time, and if you remember that soundtrack, right, I mean, it was the Stones, Motown was throughout there as well, and it just kind of reinforced to me just how powerful the music really was in people's lives. And so that was a real big part of it, was just understanding how much the music really meant to people back then. And then, you know, serendipity is always part of it, a little bit of luck. The development of the compact disc was really timely, too, because that was a moment in time where people looked at their old scratchy record libraries and said, wow, here's a really cool chance to upgrade and have this great digital format that obviously had some storage advantages as well, but just sounded great. So as people were really updating their music libraries, classic rock really kind of came around at exactly that time.
And this was different than oldies. When I think of oldies, I think of Jan and Dean, or, you know, late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah, and a big difference is that really all of the artists involved in the format, again, with a few exceptions, mm-hmm. like,
Jimi Hendrix and the Doors were still very much viable when classic rock happened. McCartney was still out there and still is today.
Yeah.
The Stones were still touring. The Who were absolutely viable. So it really wasn't what I call a rearview mirror kind of format. Classic rock really sort of had a contemporary feel, even though it showcased older music. But yeah, it was kind of next generation oldies to a great degree, yes.
I'm speaking with radio consultant Fred Jacobs, the Oakland County-based consultant who created the classic rock radio format right here in Michigan nearly 30 years ago. I saw a comment on Facebook the other day, and I don't remember the artist, but it was somebody from the 90s, and it was like, really, so-and-so is classic rock? And it reminds them all, the years march on, don't they?
Absolutely. There's been a lot of comments, especially about Nirvana, which is very likely who that comment was about, because when people realized that Nirvana broke more than 20 years ago, it's just a reminder of something that we all know. I mean, tempus fugit, right? I mean, time just flies. And it's just hard to imagine that grunge music from Seattle is well more than 20 years old. It is classic rock for a different generation. But again, that music that you grew up with, that when you first started dating was playing in the background, I mean, just all of those memories that you have as a teen, that stuff is really near and dear to you, and that's what formats are made of.
Fred Jacobs, Michigan-based radio consultant with Jacobs Media, the creator of the classic rock radio format. Pleasure to talk with you, and thank you so much, Fred.
Thanks, Cindy. Enjoyed it.
Stateside from Michigan Radio, I'm Cynthia Canty, and this is our Spring Fun Drive. We've heard about all the progress being made toward autonomous cars. The idea is you get in, you'll sit back, and let the car do the driving. But what if you can't enjoy this new technology because you're too busy throwing up or wanting to throw up, which is just about as bad? Researchers from the University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute, UMTREE, have discovered that nausea, car sickness, is a real possibility for passengers in driverless cars. Brandon Shutley is one of those researchers. Welcome to the program, Brandon. Good to have you.
Thanks.
What did you find in your research? Just how sick did people feel?
What we did was we combined information we had from a couple different studies. Specifically, we had one study where we asked people, what do you think you'll be doing as a passenger in a self-driving vehicle, since by definition you'll no longer be driving? And we did another study a few years ago, actually, where we asked people just about general motion sickness in vehicles and took a look at what it was that generated motion sickness. Unfortunately, a lot of the things people think they'll be doing in self-driving vehicles fall on that list of things that cause motion sickness.
Such as
reading, which includes things like texting, doing work, which would involve looking at your phone or video screens, generally things that take your view away from the outside world and refocus it back to the inside of the car.
Would it also depend on the distance or the type of roads, or does it just kind of happen in general?
The more you're exposed to it, the worse it gets. Mm-hmm. And often people who do get motion sickness find that if they can do short trips, it helps alleviate some of that. But the more forces your body's subjected to that you have to sort of account for as a passenger, all of these things, your inability to control the vehicle itself, so you can't really anticipate moment to moment what's going to be happening, all these things contribute to this general feeling of sickness.
Did you get a sense how many people, what percentage of possible passengers in these self-driving cars might experience this?
We expect somewhere in the 6 to 12% range will get either often, frequently, or always motion sick. And again, these are generally the same people, though not always. We found that roughly the same percentages will get severe to moderate motion sickness at some point. Not necessarily every time, but to the point where it affects your ability to travel in a vehicle.
Okay. Well, then the question comes, what is going on when this happens? Do we know what causes this?
There's a variety of factors. Your inability to control the vehicle is one of them, which leads to the inability to control your own physical posture. And all of this comes back to this disconnect that occurs between the eyes and the ears. If you're looking inside the vehicle, your ears are telling you that the world's moving around quite a bit, where your eyes are telling you nothing's moving at all. And your brain doesn't like this conflict. There's speculation that this is actually a very old mechanism in the brain that triggers when you've been poisoned, when you get this sort of disconnect between the feelings. It just so happens that motion can trigger it as well.
So kind of what happens on an amusement park ride?
Amusement park rides, IMAX or 3D movie theaters can do it, video games for some people. Video games would be the opposite. Your ears are telling you nothing's happening and your eyes are telling you the world's jumping all around. So either direction of the disconnect leads to this feeling.
Is there anything that the car makers and their engineers can do about this?
We think so. The more you can open up people's view to the outside world, I've seen some neat but possibly problematic prototypes for self-driving vehicles that have very small windows, very restricted views of the outside. A frequent thing you'll see is people facing backwards. That's something that really contributes to motion sickness. Facing forward is a big help.
And you're talking to someone who grew up in a Chevy station wagon where I was in that back row facing out back. That is not fun.
No, I'm familiar with those myself.
Yes.
Sleeping is kind of one of the magic non-medicinal cures. For people who do get motion sick, sleeping tends to keep it from occurring. If you combine that with lying back, whether you sleep or not, that also helps alleviate a lot of the symptoms. And there's certainly even some fancier things people can do with the displays in cars where they sort of mimic the motion of the vehicle to kind of keep your eyes and ears in sync with each other.
It's kind of interesting when you think we certainly hope we don't have to take a motion sickness drug in order to drive to the grocery store once the day comes when we have these self-driving cars.
That's right. And we think that's not one of the best solutions because of how frequently most people use their vehicles, having to take some sort of medication. And usually you have to take it ahead of time. Yeah. You can't take it right when you're getting in the vehicle. There's a little bit of a lead time.
But what is the message for the designers and the makers of these autonomous cars?
Don't restrict the views of the passengers. Again, we would recommend forward-facing seats. Now, this will vary from person to person. You'll get some people who will have no problems with this at all, and you'll have other people who, with all of these countermeasures we've discussed, will still have a problem in cars. But at least keep it to the current levels we have in vehicles and not make it any worse.
Brandon Shutley with the University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute with some interesting thoughts as we proceed into the new world of autonomous cars. Thanks so much, Brandon.
Thank you.
From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside, and this is our Spring Fun Drive. I'm Cynthia Canty. A recent piece in The Atlantic by writer Rachel Smith focused on cornflakes, what's in them, what's not in them, and how they were invented in Battle Creek by John Harvey Kellogg and his brother Will Keith. Well, that got us thinking. These days, cereal sales are dropping, and some Wall Street observers think Kellogg is ripe for a takeover. And because it's such a big part of the West Michigan landscape and economy, we wonder just what's behind declining sales of breakfast cereals. Darren Seifer is with us. He's a food and beverage analyst for the NPD Group, and that's where they keep close tabs on all kinds of consumer behavior. So, Darren, we hear these sales of breakfast cereals are softening, but you wouldn't know that when you walk down the grocery aisle and there's this enormous array of choices.
That's right. It is definitely a huge category. It's still the number one thing that we're having at breakfast all the time, but there's definitely more influences at breakfast time now. Certainly, we've seen across the population an emphasis around freshness, and you know that doesn't necessarily bode well if you're a category that's located in the center of the store, and particularly at breakfast time. We've seen a lot of consumers have more eggs in the morning and more pancakes in the morning. It's a way to get a little bit more freshness as they start their day.
I was actually reading your blog, and you had a post from about a year ago that really caught my eye. It was breakfast time as you visited your retired parents. And it certainly seems to be a generational difference in the approach to breakfast, isn't there?
You know, and what's interesting is that we seem to find there is a switch between millennials and Gen X as what is the meaning of convenience. It seems from Gen X and older that the traditional notion of convenience of just save me time in the kitchen, a frozen entree, things like that are still the traditional notion of convenience, and they still cling to that. But when we look at millennials and younger, it looks as though they'll spend a little more time with their products, the foods that they're going to consume, in order to get some sense of freshness out of them. I mean, make no mistake, they don't want to spend a lot of time in the kitchen. They're just like anyone else, they want to get out of there pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But they're looking for things like appliances and other shortcuts to help them finish their products and get a little bit of freshness out of it.
Well, tell me what breakfast time was with your folks.
If I remember correctly, I looked in the fridge and I was getting some eggs out of the refrigerator. You know, I like to make some eggs and put some other things in it. I'll put some spinach and some cheese, some other toppings, maybe a little bit of olives in there as well, give that Mediterranean flair to it. My folks, they'll go a little bit more for the bowl of cereal, they'll slice open a grapefruit, and, you know, that'll be that. So, you know, I spent a little more time with mine, you know, just to get just the way that I wanted it. It looks like they were still interested in just getting something just quickly on the table.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's just think about that typical box of breakfast cereal. Is there a sense you're getting that people are less drawn to a food with that very long shelf life and with sugar and sprayed with synthetic vitamins to try to make up for the fact that the most nutritious part of the kernel has been stripped out, the German brand portions? And then you add to that this growing dis-ease about genetically modified seeds?
First off, you know, let's just be certain about one thing. People are still consuming cold cereal. It's extremely convenient. It takes almost no time to prepare. And there are ones that people really do believe are very healthy. They've got whole grains. They're low in sugar. Some of them are. Let's just start right with that.
Sure.
But certainly there are other ones where people say, wow, that's a lot of sugar in that. And in fact, sugar has just recently become the number one thing that adults are saying they're trying to avoid in their diets. And then you throw on the gluten-free fad and other areas that consumers are shifting toward. And it doesn't exactly bode well for something that is sugary, gluten-laced, and not quite fresh sitting in the center of the store.
And what are cereal companies doing, or what can they do to meet this challenge?
We do know that a lot of consumers are trying to get more towards a clean label. It's not a huge thing just yet, but what we've seen is that consumers are looking for things like preservatives on the label more often. They're getting a little bit more aware of these things. So if there's any way to just first clean up the label a little bit, that might be one thing. The other thing is, how can you also associate yourself with some fresh items? Can you make your brand seem like you're the perfect addendum to, say, a cup of yogurt? Or can you be an addendum to a fruit plate? Somehow get associated with where consumers are going, and maybe that could be a way to win.
Interesting talk. Well, I know one thing. I don't know where I'd be without something to crunch on in the morning. Darren Seifer is a food and beverage analyst for the NPD Group. Darren, thanks so much for talking with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening to Stateside. This show and this podcast are made possible with your support. $5 or $10 a month helps to pay for these conversations you listen to. So make your contribution right now at michiganradio.org or call 888-258-9866.